I've always said that if God meant for women to speak in public, he would have given us stronger voices, but that hasn't worked. He keeps inviting me to speak with him. So.
Well, we're glad that you're here. We're going to go ahead and begin, and hopefully in the material that's in your notebook, we tried to give you more than we could talk through in 2 one-hour sessions, particularly leaving any time for discussion or questions, and we certainly want to do that. Or I would say maybe the easiest way in terms of questions, if there's something that comes up, you've got a question, maybe not quite case supervision in the next 5 minutes, but a question for clarification or enunciation, that'd be fine. We're very flexible in what we do. What we want to accomplish is not that you will leave here and go sit for the state license examination. That'd be great if we could do that. It would be hard to explain to our master's level students to take 2 years and spend all that money. But we are interested in giving you skills that will help you in your role as mentors or as counselors or as leaders or those kinds of issues. And Sandra and I are going to do our best to sort of co-share that time together. Let me ask sort of as a way of getting into this, what differences you see in being, let's say, in the leadership position, elder, deacon, ministerial staff, in a congregation of 750, 800 versus a congregation of 150 as it pertains to helping couples have better marriages? What would be some of the main differences from a large congregation to a relatively small congregation? This would be where you talk.
Your small congregations are going to have probably older people that are more established and not as many young people.
All right, a small congregation, you're going to have to be aware, for instance, about the age demographics. It depends on whether it's rural or urban, the setting, what they do for a living, if it's an industrialized or if it's an agrarian piece. And it might be an older congregation. It may be where folks are moving out. You're probably not going to get overwhelmed with a lot of the elderly couples coming in for marital advice. But you might have somebody that you're sitting around going, what do I do now that Harvey is retired? Now, that doesn't show up as a problem marriage, but it's like, I kind of had my life squared away. Now, all the time I turn around, there he or she is. Or, we spent all our time building this home, and now he's been reading RV magazines, bought a big diesel truck, and we're going to be gypsies for the next 20 years. So you'll have some opportunities about that. What about the possibility of resources in a particular congregation, large versus small? Fairly clear, right? If you're in the Houston area, you've got every kind of resource available to you, although you might not know about that. And I'll come back and make just a couple of notes about developing a referral system. What I've noticed is one of the key issues in dealing with marriages in small congregations is that when there's a marriage particularly that gets in trouble or comes apart, everybody knows about it. In a large congregation, if the individual is highly visible and it comes apart, it's pretty well noticed. People go like, they used to be the leader in our Sunday school class. He used to be an elder. He used to be a deacon. He actually used to preach here. Or the more noticeable the issue. Then what I've also noticed about that is when you didn't know about it, when it came to you out of the blue, when you kind of like, I haven't seen them for a while. What happened? Somebody tells you, you go, you got to be kidding me. I had no clue. What I've noticed is minister and an elder, as opposed to being therapist, is that couples in trouble, as they're developing that trouble, don't begin by coming to you. Lay away on the fast and the fire, it's on the wall, however you want to do that, or you read about it in the newspaper, before they come to the shepherd to say, we're really having some trouble. So one of the things that I would want us to think about is what can we do in a preventive way particularly as shepherds. I've been stuck for a long time with this notion from Lynn Anderson in this, shepherds don't smell like sheep. And I actually went and smelled the sheep. Not good, which is an excellent metaphor, And sheep are sometimes pretty dumb, as best I can tell, although I started raising a city boy. I thought perhaps elders could just become barking dog, kind of nip, hurt everybody. But anyway, you've got that. In my mind, one of the things that shepherds do is they put on that purple medicine, right? You kind of, the sheep come out, you look through all the fluff, and yeah, I know, but I'm going to look around in here. And you got to kind of be around and touch them and sort of examine that stuff. And when you find a spot that needs doctoring, you know, no, you're not leaving, come here. We'll put purple medicine. I have a vision that at some point in time it would be really exciting if instead of having elders meetings, we'd just kind of pack it in the car and go and visit the sheep. Let somebody else pick out the colors and whether, what kind of fertilizer we do or, those really big kind of, and just go and smell the sheep.
That's right.
Just kind of like, well, cool. Or maybe even something like this. One of the things that you do each elders meeting is you take the first 15, 20 minutes and then you invite several of the families to come in and you bless. You're not really saying, come tell us all the bad things. Just say, we want to come and we want to find out about you and we want to bless you. I have this vision that when that program starts, whoever goes to that mailbox and finds that letter from the elders.
You've been summoned to come to the elders meeting Wednesday night, 8:30, right after class.
You're going to go, what have you been doing? I would hope over time what they would go, hey, it's finally our time. We're excited. There'd be some way to remove this somewhat notion of an adversarial relationship, of a supervisory kind of relationship, rather than let me walk along with you through life. I really want to be here to help you. I can't solve all of your problems, but I will never abandon you. And so I'm always going to be with you. Through the day, or through our two sessions, we want to talk about a little bit about the family ministry, and I will say to you in that sense, I think it makes more sense for congregations to be preventive in their nature than to worry about being remedial. By that I mean it's a whole lot easier to teach people how to have good marriages than it is to hope that they'll somehow bump into it in the night, and then when it doesn't, they'll come in and we'll fix it. I will tell you, as a therapist of almost 30 years now, it's still very hard to fix troubled marriages. You can do it. You can repair them. But I tell you, when on a 1 to 10, if they come in at about a 2 or a 3, it's an uphill battle to get them to a 5. I know in our fellowship we have been very interested in marital stability. That is, when somebody asks me, what's God's plan? God's plan, I think, is to choose wisely. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Pick one. And then stick. Right? If you pick well, it's a whole lot easier to stick. Stay married. But I don't, have you been to those 50th wedding anniversaries where it just looks like somebody made it through the survivor island? they've been eating bugs and dirt for about 50 years. We're still together. How are you feeling? I said, till death we part. Are you going soon? So it's a whole lot easier to take people. And I would say that your premarital work, if you will, friendship formation, starts in the nursery. It starts just as early as you can about how you play and get along with others. It has to do with how you choose friends. So people who are in, let's say, late elementary, middle school, however it's divided up in your hometown, when they're trying to figure out who they want to run with, guess what? You're probably going to date people that you've been around. Guess what? You're probably going to fall in love with somebody you date. That makes sense? Now, that's what you were trying to tell your kids when you said, you're going out with whom? Well, what about your friends? We want to do CIA checks on our friends now, So one of the things that we're concerned about is the personality development of our individuals. That's more than we can do today, but I will tell you, it's a whole lot easier to create great marriages while they still like each other than it is to use it as a wake-up call. Oh, now that we almost, you know, both of us had a lawyer or we had the date, then we're going to get better. Those make great workshop stories, you know. Came rose out of the dust, great phoenix marriage. But that's really not the best way to do it. Sandra's going to spend some time with some premises, and she's going to tell you a little bit about our book. Mm-hmm.
I come from a ministry family. My dad was a preacher.
It must be me, I'm sorry.
They turned it up to the...
Oh, I'm sorry.
My father was a minister. My grandfather, two uncles, married a preacher. One of the things I learned in all those years of church work is the congregation, wherever we are, is a little bit of the regular broad community. You can take just a section of the community, and that's where our congregations are. The same problems you'd have in a community, you can find in the church, unfortunately. So what I want to do, it'd be great if that wasn't true, but since it is, I want to give you a framework upon which to build everything else you do with couples. I have six points. Tom and I, it's pretty well known that I have a motorcycle. We ride motorcycles, and we like to watch the motorcycle building shows on TV, you know. Well, what I'm going to tell you is kind of like the frame. These will be the frame upon which you build all the other work you do with families in your congregations. And there are six things that we think are basic premises to look at, to interpret what's going on, and to help people as they work through their relationships. The first one is that marriage can be a taste of heaven this side of eternity. Now you've heard that, the adage, marriage is heaven on earth, and that sounds pretty ridiculous and pretty naive, but for the Christian, that really is true, that as Christians, if we're already living our eternal life, it makes sense then that a Christian marriage can be a taste of heaven before we ever get there. And I think God intended for our marriages to be that way. We live in a cruel world. We live in a violent world. We live in a world where people beat us up constantly, mentally, emotionally, hopefully not too often physically. But home should be a place we can come. We can feel safe. We can know we're loved. Home should be the kind of place that it's easier for us to get to heaven rather than harder for us to do that walk. So when you hear couples say, we didn't have any business getting married. We should have, you know, we were immature. We weren't meant for each other. If you marry, Tom and I personally don't believe that there's one person just made for you. You know, we have a lot of the college students say, well, I'm just looking for the person that God has for me. And I could have married any number of people and been as happy or happier. Tom's the same, not happier. Could never be happier. But you could have married any number of women and been just as wonderful a husband and been just as happy or happier, maybe. But the fact is that we married each other. And it's our responsibility, if we live life as God intended us to, that theoretically our marriage can be very much a taste of heaven before we ever get there. And that's one of the great things about having a Christian marriage, different. And it's what the people we work with and people in our congregations, that's what they all want. If you see all the stuff on TV, those people are looking for something that's a little bit better than... That's why they're always looking, because they haven't found it yet. But I think if we can make our marriages a little bit more like heaven here, we can be a good example for the people we work with as well. Wouldn't it be great if, because we are elders and because we're leaders in the church, our marriage, it would be a perfect example for everyone. None of us has it all together. and we can always grow. But if we can live our life together, so we're an example to the flock, to the people who see us, then that's part of what marriage is supposed to be. I also want to say that all marriages last forever, in the sense that you can sever the legal part, the civil part of a relationship, of a marriage, but once we've married someone, we are forever influenced by the experience we had with each other. And to me, that carries on through eternity as well. So there are several aspects to that idea of making marriage a taste of heaven this side of eternity. Have you ever heard anybody say, "I've just got to go find myself"? Oh, I just need a break. We need to give me a little time alone so I can go figure out who I am. I've lost myself. And I want to say, take out your wallet. Look at your driver's license. Read it. Look at your picture. That's, you know, okay. Now, you don't need to go off to the boot scooting parlor to find yourself. That's who you are. Number two about the framework of helping couples is the idea that we are created in the image of God. And if we have that identity of who we are, it can't help but make a difference and how we treat each other, how we live together, the decisions we make about what we do, how harmful or helpful our relationship is going to be for the other person. I want to read a portion out of our book. Frederick Aquino is a professor at ACU, and I know I took some classes, theology classes under him, and know just enough theology to be dangerous. But I asked him if I could put this in my book, and he said, absolutely. I want to read you something that he talked about this idea of being created in the image of God. He says, the incarnation, or God created in human form and coming here in the form of Jesus, the incarnation helps us, humanity, reorient ourselves within the meaning of the image of God, so we can better understand our nature, our purpose, and our destiny. The idea that we're created in the image of God has so much to do with the decisions we make when we think of it as helping us understand our nature, our purpose, and our destiny. Jesus' sacrifice and servanthood shows us who we are and what God intended us to do and to be. So imagine living in a marriage where each person realized, I'm created in God's image, and that makes a difference in how I treat you. It makes a difference in how I feel about myself. Anytime, you know, you've heard people say, well, I'm just human. Boy, I'd love to be perfect, but I'm just human. The idea that Jesus was human and God, and he was perfect, might suggest to us that any time we are less than perfect, we're actually being subhuman. I'm just human is not an excuse that we have. It'd be great if we could live perfectly. I don't know anybody that has except Christ, but the idea that being created in the image of God, we don't have an excuse to be mean and ugly to each other because I'm just human, I can't. We really need to strive for that identity of being more like Christ. It does make a difference in how we treat each other. Number three, joy, not happiness, gives marriage its substance and stability. Joy, not happiness, gives marriage its substance and stability. You've heard people, I've had friends who've said this, and I know those of you who work with couples in your congregations have heard this. God would want me to be unhappy. And I want to say, show me scripture and verse for that. Because God did not promise us we'd always be happy. Happiness is an externally motivated emotion. And we can be happy one day and unhappy the next, depending on what comes our way, depending on what happens to us. Joy, on the other hand, is internally motivated. It's how we view what happens in our life because we know the rest of the story. We know how the story ends. We have a hope and a purpose, and that we know that there's more to life than being happy. So many times people live with the idea that happiness is the goal. If I can just do this, if I can just change this, if I can just lop off this spouse and get me another one, somehow I'm going to finally be happy. Happy is not the goal, but it is a reward every now and then. In January, I did a marathon, and through the marathon, I was in pain part of the time, and that was not happy for me. But every now and then, somebody would give me a cup of water, and I was so happy about that. I got the little orange wedges. Oh, that tasted so good. I was happy about that, even through the pain and even through the continued, the lack of energy or whatever. They took pictures along the way. Nobody knew when they were going to be snapping your picture. But I got a picture back from the company that was doing this. I've got this big grin on my face. I look like I'm strolling through the park. I was in pain. But I wouldn't have stopped for anything because I was full of joy at being able to do this. There was just not an option. I wasn't going to quit. So the idea that joy is not only the victory, but it's also the tournament. It's everything that happens in between. Joy is not just the destination, but it's the journey for the Christian. And in Christian marriages. So the idea that happiness comes often enough that we're reinforced to keep going, and happiness is great when we have it, but we can't always be happy. And that's one of the things a lot of the couples we work with don't realize. They think if they're not happy, something's wrong. And they haven't yet realized the idea that joy is a mindset that comes from inside. Happiness is something happens from outside. And I think helping them distinguish between those two things and realize that it's impossible to be happy all the time, and just because you don't feel happy right now doesn't mean you're not going to again, that's a real, real powerful concept for couples. Number four, emotions change last. So many times when couples come for help, they come because they don't like how they feel. In mental health professions, people come for help because they don't, most of the time, because they don't like how they feel, and they want you to help them feel better. They don't realize that feelings are the hardest thing to change. And the first thing they have to do is start changing the way they're thinking about things, change the way they're, some of the things they're doing. So you give them homework, you give them behaviors that they can do that will lead to feeling better. You give them different ways of thinking, different perspectives, different options, so that helps the way they're thinking. And then before you know it, when they're doing these other things, they start to feel better. But most couples, you know, the excitement's gone. We don't love each other anymore. I'm tired of being in this family. I'm not getting what I want. Those are all negative thoughts and emotions that, and they don't realize that that's not going to change. And they want the other person to change. You can't change the other person. So to help them realize that, okay, I know you want to feel better, but that's going to be hard to do, and first you're going to have to do this work. And so you help them do something different, think differently, and they start to feel better. Number five, love is the essence of God. Love, agape love. Couples say, we just don't love each other anymore. I don't love her anymore. Well, love needs to be redefined for folks. If you emerged out of a vacuum in our culture, just pretend like you've been closed up in a capsule, and all of a sudden you're let out of this capsule, and you go about your daily life trying to figure out what love is. Where are you going to find it? Somebody you can talk and tell me, where do you think, pretend like you're one of your coworkers or somebody in your congregation, and they're out looking for love. Where are they going to find what love is? What kind of messages are they going to get? Magazines? Novels? There's a story about the Walmart right down the street from ACU. We had Fabio come. Fat Fabio with the long flowing hair. His picture's on the front of these romance novels. He came to the Walmart in Abilene to do a book signing because more of those novels are sold in that store than any place else. People buy those books and they're looking for something. And women usually read those more than men. So guys have a pretty hard time trying to live up to this, this unreal kind of love that we're fed from the media. Entitlement to be loved. I deserve to be loved, but most of us don't really know what that is. We can't put it into words, so we end up jumping through hoops with each other, trying to be loving, trying to do what the other person will make the other person feel loved, when we don't really know what that is. I had a couple come in to my office, and when I asked him his goal for the for therapy, he said, "Well, I just want to love my wife more." In more discussion of that, what he meant was, I want to feel more warmly toward her. The sad part about it was, she always, in the course of therapy, it became obvious she had a way of sabotaging whatever he tried to do for her to show her that he loved her. When we talked about love being a verb, a behavior, that it's not just an emotion, when you feel warm and loving toward each other, that's great. Let's capitalize on that. What's going on when you're feeling that way, and what can we do to make that happen more often? But we don't always feel warmly toward each other, and just because that warm feeling's gone doesn't mean we don't love each other. If we're doing for the other person what we can to show them we love them, no matter how we feel. Tom and I, I know the things that I can do for him that he feels cared about, and he knows those for me too. But, sometimes the emotions of, over the years, warmth have not always been there. That's normal. That comes and goes. But helping couples realize that love is a behavior. And this young man was doing everything he could. I said, you say you wanted to learn to love your wife more, but you're telling me lots of things that you're doing. You're jumping through every hoop in the world with love, showering her with loving behaviors, which is what love is. He was sacrificing greatly for her, but what he really wanted was the emotion to be there. So we need to help couples realize that love and the warm feelings are one thing, but love actually is a behavior and something that we do for each other. And then the last one, number 6, is read the instructions. So often we buy a book, one of the gimmicks, and it's more fun to just, we have to do more training to get a driver's license than we do a marriage license. And so, as with Tom, I don't think they even had premarital counseling when Tom and I were getting married. It was unheard of. But we kind of knew we liked each other and we thought we loved each other, so we kind of got together with the idea that we're in this to the end. And but we had a lot of learning to do, trial and error. And what the premise of that, if you read the instructions, which are in God's Word, He tells us how to live together. He tells us how to treat each other. He tells us in those rough times what decision to make. He tells us to pray for our enemies. Let no unwholesome talk come out of your mouth except what's designed to build each other up. The instructions are there on how to have a good marriage. Not always going to be happy, because life gives us things that hurt us, even if our spouse doesn't. But read the instructions. A couple of things. Can I talk about the kiss and a prayer? I want to end with two things that we ask couples to do when they're to help with their marriage. The first thing is we ask them to start praying together every day out loud sometime during the day. And a lot of couples have never done that. Sometimes it's embarrassing. But if you can kind of get your feet wet and pray together, it's wonderful to hear. It's hard to be mad with each other if you know your spouse is going to be taking your name. You know, you're going to be going together to the throne of God at the end of the day. So it does a lot to help your attitude toward each other during the day. So praying together. And the second thing, I want to read you something. We ask couples to adopt a special kiss in their relationship. It's the kind of kiss that if the world knew it existed, marriages would be a whole lot better, just in general. I want to read this. Receive thee one another, and let us kiss one another. Think not that this kiss ranks with those given in public by common friends. It is not such. For this kiss blends souls one with another, solicits for them entire forgiveness. Therefore, this kiss is the sign that our souls are mingled together and have banished all remembrance of wrongs. This kiss, therefore, is reconciliation, and for this reason, holy. If couples in, I started saying the free world, I work in a prison, so if couples in the free world, if the general population had a kiss like that, that blends souls one with another, solicits entire forgiveness, is a sign that our souls are mingled together, banished all remembrance of wrongs, a kiss of reconciliation. If every marriage had that kind of kiss every day, would that not be wonderful? Wouldn't that solve a lot? So we had a young couple, we're talking about this in a class, Wednesday night class, and the next week one of these really sweet couples came. The guy was so enthusiastic about doing the class with his wife and working through the book and all that. And he said, we have a question about the kiss. I said, really? What? He said, well, we don't know what kind of kiss that is. Is that like a kiss in the hand? Is that like a kiss on the cheek? Is it like a kiss on the mouth? What is it all about? And so we hadn't really thought about it. But we talked about it could be whatever kind of kiss they wanted it to be. But also the idea that this kiss is not so much, it is wonderful for the person you're giving it to. Man, I need to forgive you. Come here and let me give you. But not that kind of kiss. It can be wonderful for the person that you're giving it to, your spouse. But more importantly, it's for you. I am banishing all remembrance of wrongs. I am soliciting forgiveness from you. And so this holy kiss, there's really something wonderful. Now this comes from the lectures on the Christian sacraments from Jerusalem in 4th century A.D. So that holy kiss has been around for a while. And I think since our spouse is first and foremost our brother or sister in Christ, that why not have a holy kiss for that in that relationship? So those are two things that we ask couples to start doing, and we enjoy doing it as well.
Correct. Yesterday, we were waiting on the airplane at Abilene. Young soldier got off of the airplane in his Iraq camouflage fatigues and was met there by his young wife, no children yet. And I thought as they embraced and kissed one another after his deployment, returning from his deployment, how great it would be to have a picture of that so that they could continue to see how much they loved one another and how happy they were to be in one another's arms at that particular moment for the times when things get rough. You have in your notebook on the first page of the formal notes a top 10 problems couples face. You might put this against your list of things that come your way on things that are challenging couples in your particular congregation or that would come to you. And this ranking is the number one problem is communication. down through the 10th or whatever, you might have a little bit of variance. But I can tell you that most marital couples coming in, even some premarital couples coming in, if you'd ask them what's the biggest problem you have, you're going to have this as an answer, a failure to communicate. So one of the easy things for you to fix in the preventive idea is to find either individuals, consultants that can come in, people in your congregation that are already trained, and you can do a Saturday morning workshop or an all-day workshop and train people to effectively communicate. There's a whole industry available in teaching people how to communicate. If you're in the corporate world, you have people come in that help corporations learn to communicate. I think the real trick here is not so much that we're not communicating, because I tell you, and it's not good grammar, but you cannot not communicate. People come in complaining, I don't like what I'm hearing. That's a problem. So if we're trying to have a conversation and you're falling asleep, that's a problem in communication. If you're, you know, watching indoor major lacrosse on TV and I want to talk to you, that's a problem. If you want to talk 4 hours, I want to talk 4 minutes, that's a problem. Now, the other problem here is that women want to solve their problems more through talking than men do. Right, guys? Yeah. I'm not trying to be stereotypic, but one of the things that I would want you to take home is that men have, they believe, given God has given them a dominant gene called the I'll fix it gene. I'm going to fix it. Hi, hon. How'd it go at work today?
Everybody at work giving me a hard time.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah. Oh, and, you don't know what to do about it.
But I think I can get a
hand. Well, give me a little more detail.
Well, the officers are not cooperating. They, you know.
Hey. Here's what you need to do. Look familiar? I ran into the closet, pulled on my tights called Super Fix It, and I quit listening because I went into my fix it mode, because after all, that's what I'm trained to do, is to solve things, fix things. And by the way, if I can fix it, I don't have to listen to this. So I want to fix it instead of listening. Just love me anyway, but have you noticed in our fellowship, most of our elders are men? So when somebody brings a problem to us, what do we want to do, guys? Fix it. Make it go away. Let's all love each other. You know, we have a friend in the business world, Sandy used to work for. And he got real frustrated when the meeting was just going south and it was having a real big argument. He said, oh, we're just going to pray. So he just, you know, there's about 20 people in the room. And they're all going, what? Nothing wrong with praying. We've already said that's a great thing. But one of the issues about communication, have you noticed there's some people that would just want to do a little bit and then others want to just do a lot? Talk it. Think of it this way. They come in, they've told you, well, you know, we have failed to communicate. Why don't you go home and just talk about it? One's going, hey, yes. The other one's going, oh, no. It's this way. You've gone out to dinner. It's a fairly nice restaurant. It's not just one of those feeding events. It's a dinner. It looks like a date. And you've ordered things with more than $10. And in the middle of that, she looks at you and says, you know, while we're here, there's something about our marriage I'd like for us to discuss. My first thought is, I've just blown $40. Now, it is cheaper than marriage therapy. We, you know, it depends. But I'm thinking, why did I just get nervous about that? Because when you hear those words, let's talk about it, I automatically think it's going to be something negative rather than positive. So here's a suggestion you make to your couples. One of the things that we would suggest is you spend more time talking about things that are positive than you do talking about things that are negative. Hello, that's not hard. Well, is there any scripture that goes along with that? Sandra gave you, in fact, the next session we're going to look at a number of scriptures that I think are directly applicable to the marital issue, and most of them do not have in it the word husband or wife. There are very few of those, unfortunately, in text. The fortunate part is the relationship passages in there about one anothering and servanthood and applicable to what we do in marriage. So the notion is, as Sandra said out of Ephesians 4, don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth unless it's designed to build one another up. So when we talk to one another, is my intention in communication to build you up. The other one that I really like to use with couples is one that maybe occurred during their wedding ceremony, if somebody read 1 Corinthians 13. And in the middle of 1 Corinthians 13, great little phrase that says, love doesn't keep a record of wrong. So when somebody wants to know if they violated any scripture in their marriage, you always know they've done that one. Because they come up to you and they have a laundry list of stuff that go from here to the back door of all these grievances, and they've been dragging that mess around rather than working through it and getting rid of it. It would be great at the end of the day you could always hit that little delete button, and like my computer, it would forget everything. Communication. Helping people communicate. A second big piece in communication is, more often than not, what they want is agreement, not understanding. They think if we're not agreeing, then we're not communicating. I want to be accurate. Randy already kind of preached a little bit of that today. He said, I don't mind you disagreeing with me, just understand what it was I'm saying. That comes from nearly anybody that's given public stuff. It's like, you know, it's okay for you to not be where I am, but just if you're going to get on to me about it, at least understand where I am. So the technique is called shared meaning in communication. Shared meaning. One person's the speaker, another person is the listener. In the book, there's a whole chapter on this and exercises and kind of thing. So we're just going to kind of role play very briefly. But that's not the... When am I supposed to be? When do we get out? At half hour? At 10:30? Okay.
Oh.
All right. So one of the... Let me just say, I really was excited about you agreeing to come and do this workshop, this Elder Link, and I'm just tickled that you're here.
You're glad I'm here? You're tickled about that?
Yeah, I really am. What about you?
I love being with you. I consider doing workshops a gift I give you.
Okay, I quit paying attention about halfway through that. Could you say that to me again?
I always enjoy going places and being with you.
When I get too close to you, I hear things. You really enjoy us doing these kinds of things together?
No, not exactly.
Oh, we don't enjoy doing it, but you enjoy being with me.
Right. Oh, I enjoy being with you. I never do the speaking part comfortably, but it's a gift I do for you because I know you like for me to do that. And I will gladly do that.
Okay. One being the speaker, the other one being the listener. The listener's job is to listen and then send back to me one of that kind of certified mail deal. Let me tell you what I was hearing and see if I got it right. Peace. And if I didn't get it right, send it to me again. If I didn't understand it, send it to me again. It's a little bit different than being a tape recorder and just sort of parroting it back. You need to just, you can do that. That's better than nothing. Think of it as ordering at a fine restaurant where they actually have a wait person instead of driving through and talking to a fiberglass burro or something, you know. We were last night at Papa Something or Other's. Cetus, Papa Cetus, great deal. We had a British waiter that, go figure. But anyway, but one of the things that Sean did that was like this, for each of the, I don't know, where there were 12 or 14 of us, he repeated back what we ordered and would clarify. Now, was that beef or chicken or, you know, goat or, you know, whatever it was that we were ordering? And we said, yeah, that's our order. Now, what he didn't know is it was an older group, and we couldn't remember by the time he brought it what it was. So everybody was happy. Yeah. So number one is communication.
Let me say a couple of things about communication. When you're, the couples that you work with will have four views of marriage. They'll have his view, her view, and then his view of her view, and her view of his view.
So they actually bring four different... Say that again. I got lost. Say that again.
Four views of the marriage and... When they come in, instead of just two.
Instead of two, there's four.
Yeah. His view.
My view of the marriage.
Mm-hmm. My view, and your view.
Mm-hmm. And my view about your view. I think this is what you think.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I make decisions and live in our marriage based on what I think you think.
Okay. So now if I'm one of these people and I'm in the room, then there's my view of the marriage and my view of your view, your view of my view. His view of my view, his view of my view of your view, his view of your view, his view of your view of my view.
Okay.
And we're trying to get what's true.
Clarify.
Okay. That would be a communication problem. Now, within that, our overall advice for you is to learn to ask elegant questions. It's more about asking elegant questions than it is about delivering nodes of wisdom to these people. Most of the people, I'll put it above 90%, most of the people that come already know how to fix this thing. They do not need more information. In our fellowship, the strategy, particularly at a congregational level, is if there's something wrong or we want something fixed, preach a series of sermons, right? There have been enough sermons preached to fix all marriages since and future. It's not an ignorance issue. When, you know, the deacon runs off with the Sunday school supervisor, it's not an ignorance issue. So learn to ask elegant questions. I'd put it this way. Any fisher people persons? Good. Okay, that's great. And we would fish, but there's no water in Abilene, so... And then those rod and reel things where you've got all that string stuff, if you really don't know what you're doing and you throw it and it goes, and you look down in that casting, what do you call that? A bird's nest, a rat's nest, all right? That's great. How do you fix that? How do you get it back to where it's supposed to be?
Take
a knife and cut it out. All right. Now, you say, okay, for me, here's that. You know, one end of that's tied to the way underneath in the bottom of that spool, and it goes through all those eyelets, and it goes out, and blah, 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 and it's out up there. Okay, now, the deal is nobody took that loose and tied a knot in it, but it got in a knot. It's a mess. It got too much, you know, it was going too fast, and then whatever. Now, one of the things that you can do is grab one in, and start pulling, and it's not going to come out. All it's going to do is get tighter. Another idea, you can keep working with it, is you can just kind of rub on it. You can kind of massage it. You can kind of do that, and then you kind of do that. And more often than not, you can get that bird's nest, rat's nest knot out of there. You know, it's my idea is who goes around to all of these houses tying my... garden hose in knots. You know, it's like, what happened? When a knot in a relationship won't respond to loving, gentle massage, one of the things you can do is just abandon it, cut it out, tie it off, keep on going. You don't throw it away and get a new rod and reel. You do that. I have a line that I quote Charlie Seibert on that I'm sure it's original with Charlie, but anyway, that explains you, it doesn't excuse you, right, Charlie? That's one of his deal. I use it, and most of the time give him credit for it. Depends. Most of the time do it. We heard another one recently that's talked about, particularly with Sandra being in prison. It's like, well, I think the statute of limitations has run out on that problem. Now, I don't know where the logical end of that, but we have people that come in like, oh, you know, well, when did that happen? Well, it happened 23 years ago. I think the statute of limitations is out on that one. Now, if it happened yesterday, that's probably not a great line. But there are some of these things that you cannot, because it's a historical event, you cannot change. But you can hardwire around that thing. Communication. Power struggles. Who's going to be in charge? I will ask clients, which of you is the most stubborn? Now, I would say my therapeutic style, most of the time, is in a model called cognitive behavioral family therapy or marriage and family therapy. You can put a, it's a little too long if you say, well, I'm a cognitive behavioral emotional family therapist. You know, they think you just cry a lot when you do that. But the three building blocks of all therapy is what you think, what you do, and what you feel, your affect. Those are the three things that I would want you to be aware of. So elegant questions that you can either find in our material and other places is to help people what... Do you remember when your kids did something really stupid? Or you were the kid and your parents asked, what were you thinking about? And your answer was, nothing. Well, no, you were thinking about stuff. I got home one day, it had been snowing in Dallas, which didn't happen often. I was in junior high school. I made a slush par, I mean, a pretty good little thing. And there was a car coming down the road, and I kind of threw it at it, and it kind of hit it, and I was kind of proud till I got home. My mom wasn't supposed to be home, but she got a snow day. Came home, she said, Tom, saw you throw, why'd you do that? Well, I'm thinking about being a physics major, and I was looking at the compression ratio of ice crystals and a little of the trajectory toward moving. I don't know. Power struggles. Who's the most stubborn? I want my way, you want your way. Couples have to learn to find midpoints. They have to find midpoints. We're going to talk briefly in a moment about how to get through how to come up with some problem-solving stuff.
Yesterday at work, a lady came to me and she said, I'm really frustrated with my husband. His father is in a nursing home, and I end up going and taking care of him. And when my father-in-law lived with us, my husband wouldn't let me put him in a nursing home because he wasn't going to do that to his father. But now that he is in the nursing home, we had no choice. He fell and got hurt the other day, and my husband didn't go take care of him. I had to go and make sure they were taking care of him. What am I going to do about this? And when you talk about power struggles, I said, Miss Jones, the person who cares the least has the most power. What was happening, first of all, her husband probably knew that she was going to take care of it. He could have been... You know, he could have not wanted to see his father like that. He could have any number of reasons why he wouldn't go. But when you talk about power struggles with couples, the person who cares the least has the most power in that relationship. And so what I encouraged her to do, she said, well, what's going on with that? Why won't he go? And I said, have you asked him? Well, he gives me some nondescript answer, blah, blah, blah. And so we talked about several reasons why that might be difficult for him to go and check on him. But I said to her, you want him to want to go. You are using up a lot of emotional energy because he's not doing what you think he ought to. So just, if you care about your father-in-law and you're going to go see him as a gift to your father-in-law, because and you're doing it for you because you care. But if you get in those power struggles, you can look at the couple, see what's going on, and the one who cares the least will always have the most power. And so to try to modulate that power as part of doing good therapy and helping couples look at that. Because a lot of times the one who is feeling the most helpless they can do some really important things to change that whole dynamic, and you can help them do that by adjusting the power.
I was preaching in Pontiac, Michigan. The deacon came in. He was very distraught. It's one of the few times had a male actually come in first, and he said, "I don't know what's happening." I said, "What?" You know, he said, "Well, every afternoon when I come back from work," he worked on the line at Pontiac Assembly, "his job was to put on rear view mirrors, and he'd been putting on rear view mirrors on Pontiac Assembly line for the last almost 10 years. He went in every day, kind of by the same route, drove the same truck, ate the same lunch, and put rear view mirrors on Pontiac automobiles all day. He drove back home, and he would walk in. His complaint was, when I walk home and sit down at supper, she looks at me and she says, 'Well, how'd your day go? What'd you do?'" Now, I would grant you, he was not what I would call Mr. Excitement from the get-go, but it was like, "Well, hon, I don't know. Rearview mirrors." Now, you women know that that was a coded question she was asking, right? She didn't care about rearview mirrors or how many it was. Somewhere, and I kind of dropped my deal, so I don't know what your order is. There's a, in your book, there's, it says 10 ways to start a conversation. One of the things that, you know, I think you could do, somebody, here's some better conversational starters than what you've probably been doing. One of the things that we do through conversation is we self-disclose a little bit about who we are and what's going on. And we may not want to get down into some of those areas. We want to be a little more guarded. So I've just given you, and these are not magic, they're just some things that we've found that work over time. But it's easier to get good answers if you ask good questions. So in conversational starters, you can use those and look through that. There's another sheet in your handout. It says Elder Link, and then it says presenting problems, and then there's an assessment exercise. I want to tell you that this particular activity will help you help the couple find areas of strengths and areas of concerns. I tried not to use the word weakness or illness or those kind of catastrophic terms. I will usually tell couples, I haven't found anything. You haven't told me, this is at the end of the first session, I haven't found or heard anything that I think is terminal. Now, I always have in the back of my mind, Paul on the road to Damascus, headed in a 100% different way than the way after his encounter of being a changed man. So by being a minister, by being a therapist, by being in a Christian community, change is our number one game. The things that people don't want to hear from you is that things can get better. They want you to certify that things aren't going to get better, and so it only makes sense for them to get out of this relationship. That's really what they won't tell you that, but that's really what, I'll drive, we hear you're the best. What do you think? I think it can get better. Oh, rats. Now we'll have to drive and find somebody else. It's like Sandra in the marathon. I picked her up at 13.1. I picked her up at 20, and I picked her up about 26 miles. And took a couple of those smiling pictures. I thought she was just gritting her teeth, but she thought it was a smile. It's okay. But we have to keep running. No, I'm not going to give you a license to get out. It's not for, I don't know. Maybe sometimes I say in those vows, better or worse, sickness or in hell, until somebody dies forever kind of stuff. So this is just a list. And as you have some time today, if you have some questions about that, you can look through that. How to become one. Actually, my workshop notes from talking to high school kiddos about how to, and parents about how you choose one. Things that you need to do. I've been razzed. I have a I won't burden you with it, sort of a notion of if you send a kid down to the grocery store to pick a watermelon, what strategy would they choose? Most of them are going to look at the rind and come home and eat the heart. They need to learn to do that when they're dating, because the rind's going to do all kinds of morphing over the next 50 years. Hopefully the heart is what we're all interested in. So if I go, I think that's all of the things that I have there. I'm going to take, no, I'm not. We're going to quit on time. 10:30. If you come back this afternoon, what I want to do is help us look at the text, because as spiritual leaders, our primary role, I think, is to help couples understand text. There are people in your congregation that need to get in touch with the text to help them have successful marriages, more so than taking time out watching Dr. Phil and Dr. Oprah and the way these people sort of prostitute their lives in front of things. It's interesting, if you get on Dr. Phil's website, it'll say in there, this is for entertainment purposes only. And hopefully they're doing some good along the way.
But we're going to go over
We'll finish those as well as do the material that's in. Let's close with a prayer. Father, we invite you into our hearts and into our lives, and we invite you into our marriages. And Father, we ask you to help us as we help others to catch the joy that you promise us through your Son, Jesus, we pray. Amen.